You look like you're ready to proceed.
Thank you, Justice Holland. Good afternoon. May it please the court. Santino Chakoti on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Tiffany Parker. The sole issue in this case is regarding the admissibility of social media evidence that was used in the case in the state's case in chief against Tiffany Parker in this matter, and whether the evidence met the threshold reliability and authentication purposes of 901. And this court, we had argument, as the court recalls, in September, and it asked for discussion regarding a law review article regarding social media evidence. The appellant's position remains the same regarding the lack of authenticity of the evidence as why it should not, the court abused its discretion in admitting it.
You understand when we go on bonk, as our custom with panel arguments, the five of us never talked to each other before an argument, and you need to assume that this is the first time it's ever been argued so that everybody has the same background.
Certainly, Justice Holland. The facts and circumstances of this case involve a printout of a social media profile site from the complainant. And the significance of that is that the statements that were moved to be admitted were statements from the defendant's social media website. And I think what gets glossed over both in maybe the papers to this court is that the state did not try to admit the profile of the of the defendant. It's the profile of the complainant, which had the messages on her profile. And the significance of that is critical because in most of the cases that analyze this type of evidence, as the articles suggested, deals with the admission of the virtual author, their profile. So we actually have a copy and paste of information from someone else's site onto this site. So there's a larger disconnect. The link is weaker.
Just so I make sure I understand your position, your position is that the law, the rule should be that this type of electronic social media evidence is not admissible from the standpoint of authentication unless it can be established, that the proponent can establish that that it could not have been falsified. Is that correct? The court has to make that affirmative finding?
No. Justice Jacobs, that's not what our position is. That's the position taken by the authors of the article, that what one line of cases, they bifurcate the line of cases in this area. One line of cases is what you suggested, which is that the proponent has to disprove that this is actually not a forgery or some type of manipulation. We're not proposing that. That's a higher standard. We believe that 901 and its role with 104 is perfectly sufficient to adapt its rules to social media evidence. However, as Magistrate Grimm indicates in the Lorain decision, and as he indicates in the Law Review article, social media is still a different form of evidence that requires some scrutiny when you're going through the rules of 901. In fact, the state suggested in its briefing, and as it did previously here, that we're asking for a new subset of rules, that 901 does not apply to social media evidence.
Well, I'm still not certain from your answer what the rule should be.
901 is sufficient. 901 is sufficient. 901B1 and 901B4 articulate the ways that we can authenticate information and evidence. The problem is, when you're dealing with social media evidence, because there is a potential for manipulation, fraud, and forged accounts, there has to be a heightened scrutiny when you look at the evidence that's required.
Are you still relying on the Maryland Court of Appeals decision in Griffin? Do you urge that we adopt that court's holding that as to the methodology for achieving admissibility of social media evidence?
We do, Justice Ridgely, but only so far as the primes in Griffin actually encompass 901. Our position is that Griffin does not establish a different set of rules than 901. It's simply 901. It's what Griffin proposes is what's already in 901.
So is it 901 plus?
It's 901 plus enhanced scrutiny with social media evidence. And the reason is because if we put the body of case law in this area on a continuum, and we put the facts of Parker, they don't rise to the level where courts are admitting this type of evidence.
Well, could I stop you at this point, and would you state specifically with this particular evidence what would have been sufficient to authenticate it?
Well, for starters, Justice Berger, we can start by having the actual profile of the defendant in this case. So they're trying to get in messages of the defendant. Well, let's get her profile and the circumstances surrounding her profile before the court to evaluate. That wasn't done here. We've got
Wait a second. What would that accomplish in terms of proving authenticity?
Well, the case law tells us what that accomplishes is gathering indicia of reliability and circumstances that, when you total them up, you come to the conclusion that it's likely from the alleged author's website, or it's from their MySpace page, that a reasonable juror could conclude it might be from that individual. We're not proving that it's generally authentic.
Okay, I'm just trying to get clear how this would work, or needs to work under your view. So the first thing would be that the state would have to obtain an actual profile of the defendant, right, off of Facebook.
Correct. If that's whose messages they want in, they need to start with their profile.
All right. Are those messages necessarily going to be on that profile?
Well, that's where they came from in this case. And usually that's what happens in most of these cases, is that someone is sharing, copying and pasting information that somebody else wrote and putting it on someone else's website. That's why this type of evidence needs to be highly scrutinized, is because of the possibility that it's manipulated as such.
Well, why isn't it for the jury to do that scrutiny?
Because if we look at 901 and its interplay with 104A, that determination first has to be done by the trial court. They have to first find that it meets a certain foundation even before it gets to the jury.
Okay, so getting back, is there anything else that you think needed to be done in order to authenticate the evidence that was introduced?
Certainly. There should have been a there should have been more evidence, circumstantial evidence, under 901B4 to link the defendant's profile to the message. So, for example, the trial court used the Valdez case when it relied upon finding that this was sufficient. But if we carefully review the Valdez case, we find that the reason they did not admit, or I'm sorry, the reason that they admitted such evidence is because there was evidence of password requirements to post and delete content, as the court points out, that strongly suggests control of the website. So evidence that somebody controls this form of media that has the ability to post and delete and alter whatever is on the site. And so that's why what we take issue with, which the article suggests, is that there's two lines of cases. We don't see two lines of cases. We see different facts that determine why courts are going in different directions.
But the problem is that obviously the trial court has discretion as to whether to introduce, allow evidence into evidence, allow information into evidence. And the trial court needs some assistance in how to exercise that discretion in this special area.
Sure.
And to say that it's a continuum means that every case is going to be a toss-up, whereas it would be helpful if this court perhaps could say, here are the kinds of things that would be sufficient to establish authenticity, and then let the jury make the ultimate determination whether it's going to accept the evidence or not. So it would be helpful to the extent that you believe there are certain factors or certain types of evidence in support of it that would provide the needed authenticity.
Certainly, Justice Berger, and I think when I reference the continuum, it's really this body of case law that's out there, and there's, I believe, 8 or 9 cases that have addressed this exact issue. So there's definitely a blueprint out there for what type of circumstantial evidence is required. For one, we need to have, as I mentioned before, we've got to have the profile of the alleged author of these statements, as opposed to somebody else's website who's just copying and pasting and taking what they choose. And the reason why that's critical is because if you have that person's Facebook or MySpace page, there's going to be circumstances on that page that might help to authenticate whether something rises to the level that a reasonable juror could conclude that that person posted it.
All right, well, let me follow up because I'm not that good at this stuff. Couldn't the person who originally posted this on their own page delete it?
Yes, they can alter it, they can delete it, sure.
Okay, so if the state gets the actual profile of the defendant, in this case, from the website, that profile might show the same information, or it might not, right?
That's correct.
So you seem to be saying that if the defendant's profile page still has exactly this same statement on it, then it would be acceptable to introduce the statement into evidence. But if for some reason the defendant had deleted it from her page, then it would not be admissible?
No. I think when I talk about step one, or it's one of many factors that courts are looking at when they're evaluating whether it rises to the level of whether it's authentic enough to admit it into evidence. The purpose of getting the original website of the author is because there's indicia of reliability all over that webpage that might point to the fact that this is John Smith's website. This is where it came from because his birthday is there. His picture is all over the place. He says he lives in Wilmington, Delaware. Those are the type of things that printing these websites can show whether it's enough circumstantial evidence. In fact, the cases that the state cites to, and I can't stress this enough, I believe it's Valdez and Tienda, in those cases, they actually were able to link the email addresses to the person who owns the website. Now, that's probably a closer case. Obviously, the court had to struggle with those types of facts, but we're so far from there in this case. We're not even in the same atmosphere as having those type of facts where they've got email addresses, where the person lives. All we have is a snippet from someone else's website.
But don't we also have content here that, from your side's perspective, is exculpatory? And can that be factored in as being an indicator of reliability?
Justice Richard, that is one factor that the courts look to, is the specificity of the content that's being reviewed. Our position remains that it's still general in nature. It discusses an altercation. It does not mention names. In the cases where authentication was considered and they admitted it, is because there were actually references to people's names, who they are. So I still think we lack in the specificity in this case of the content. And the fact that there's a exculpatory, that doesn't negate the fact that there's also implicating evidence that likely led to a conviction in a case that was a very close case because it was a credibility contest. It was she said, she said in this matter.
Well, doesn't it have Tiffany Parker's name in the on the exhibit?
You say as the MySpace. Yes, I'm sorry. When I mention names, I'm mentioning the content itself, whether it references who wrote it, who she is, who the complainant is. All the only content here is information about the altercation, even though it says it belongs to Tiffany Parker. But again, that's the problem. We don't know where this website originated from. There's just no information about that.
Is it your position that no jury could reasonably find that the evidence was authentic?
That's correct. Under the facts and circumstances of this record before this court, it should not have gone through 901A and also 104A so that it would even get to a jury. Because if we get to 104A, there's still the issue of conditional relevancy. So we don't even get that far.
Why, even if that's correct, would that error not be harmless?
Why would that not be harmless?
Correct.
Because this was a... Shania Brown, the witness who was the complainant in this case, was the state's key witness. And so when they introduced the Facebook messages through her testimony, it bolstered their case. It implicated Ms. Parker in the altercation. And this case was nothing more than a credibility contest. So it would be conjecture to assume that the jury did not consider these Facebook messages in their determination.
So you're saying it was a she said, she said.
Absolutely.
And the Facebook entry tipped the scales.
That's correct, Justice Jacobs. And if I can also add to that same point, there wasn't I realize this is an independent panel from the last panel we had, but there was an issue that came up I believe it was the Chief Justice, that brought up the issue of involuntariness of a confession and how this might, what's the interplay between what happens in those situations. In those cases, the jury is instructed. At the very least, the jury should have been instructed on this type of evidence. But to just give it to them to consider also adds to the harm because you're not given any guidance as to how they're to consider it. If I could, I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very well.
May it please the court, good afternoon, Andrew Vella on behalf of the state. The trial court in this case did not abuse its discretion in admitting the Facebook post of Tiffany Parker. The post itself had a picture of Tiffany Parker. The post itself had her name on it, and it spoke about the recent attack on the victim. It was exculpatory in nature, but nonetheless identified her as being in a fight hours before. It also identifies her location near Wilmington, which is where this happened.
Mr. Vella, do you and Mr. Ciccotti agree or disagree on the standard that this court should apply in determining whether or not Facebook or social media type evidence is authentic?
We disagree.
Okay. What do you understand to be his position and what is yours?
I believe, as Mr. Ciccotti said, this requires, under the defense's position, some enhanced scrutiny because of its nature, because it's social media. However, the state's position is that is not the case. The rules, as they are written and as they should be considered, are adaptable to this kind of media, certainly. When you read Judge Grimm's article, it lays out the blueprint, talks about the interplay between 901 and 104, and the state would suggest that is certainly critical here. In providing a blueprint for a trial court to consider this.
Is your contention that the standard that we should be applying is whether a reasonable jury could find the proffered evidence to be authentic?
Correct.
Even though there may be evidence going the other way?
Correct, Your Honor. I believe that when we talk about evidence going the other way, you have the general interplay between 104 and 901, but then there's 104A and 104B, which are distinct. And under 104A, it is the trial judge that makes the determination about authenticity. So the state the proponent of the evidence must provide evidence that the judge is satisfied a reasonable juror could find to be authentic. And if the judge makes that determination, then the evidence is in, and the judge has made the determination about the authenticity, although the judge, he or herself, does not have to be satisfied. It's only would a reasonable juror be able to find that it's authentic. When you have a dispute about the evidence, whether it's authentic, a genuine dispute, then it's 104B. And in that case, the judge does not make the determination as to authenticity, and the preferred route is to allow that to go to the jury, and they determine the authenticity, and that is with a special instruction given to the jury.
That's when you have a standoff, correct?
When there's a standoff, but and to clarify that, there genuinely has to be a dispute. It can't just be an objection, argument, and then conjecture.
Right.
Because in that case, if you were to give an instruction, you'd be asking the jury to speculate on what's on the other side.
Well, so basically, and tell me if I have it or don't have it right, what the judge is, as the state sees it, what the judge is supposed to do is not unlike what happens on a motion for a directed verdict. That is there enough evidence of authenticity to go to the jury?
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. And the judge makes that determination under 104A and considers that, again, in tandem with 901, depending on the evidence that is proffered. And in this case, the state gave the judge sufficient evidence under 901B1 and 901B4. The victim in this case, and I think we lose sight of it a little bit in the papers, however, the victim in this case had previous Facebook contact. She had her own Facebook account, knew how to use it, had previous Facebook contact with the defendant months before this happened, and there was a back and forth, and that was essentially the source of or the motive for this attack. They were inboxing one another, which I guess is just a way of messaging one another on Facebook, and what the victim did was share the post that Tiffany Parker made.
How would it work procedurally? Let's say a defendant hypothetically wants to get before the court information that my account was hacked, and these are not my words, but this is being used as an admission or at least evidence of words coming out of the defendant's own mouth, like a statement. But the same defendant does not want to testify in front of the jury. So is there a procedure where, as to the voluntariness of a statement, where there could be a motion and a hearing out of the presence of the jury to address authenticity?
Under 104C, the court is permitted to take that kind of evidence outside the hearing of the jury to determine whether or not that such evidence is going to come in without having it, again, before the jury. If the defendant wants to testify in that proceeding, the defendant can testify in that proceeding and is protected under 104C.
But that didn't happen here.
That did not happen here.
And can you tell me exactly how this came before the court and the court made its decision? Was there an objection? I assume there was an objection.
There was an objection. The victim had advised the prosecutor that there was a Facebook post. The prosecutor, along with a social worker and the victim, accessed the victim's page, found the post or the repost from Tiffany Parker, and printed it out, showed it to the defense, and the defense made an objection. There was an objection, but it was that 104A situation where it was an objection and conjecture. We don't know who posted this. We don't know. No one was there to witness Ms. Parker actually make this post and type it out. And that's on page, I think it's A11. So there was an objection, but it was not, it was that 104A situation where it was an objection and then conjecture, but nothing, no affirmative evidence, which would take you to 104B. And in that case, where we're considering this evidence under 104A, the judge just has to make the determination about whether any reasonable juror could find it authentic.
Well, Mr.
I just want to clarify this one point. So there were, at no time did the defense attorney say, we have reason to believe that this is not authentic, that this has been doctored or that it's a hacked account or something along those lines. It was just anything like that could have happened, not that we have some reason to believe that it did happen.
That is correct.
Okay.
Well, to follow up, I surmise that if there's a reason or a basis for an argument that there should be enhanced scrutiny in the case of social media type evidence, it's because there's a much higher risk or susceptibility of falsification. I understand that it is not your or the state's position that the proponent of this type of evidence needs to show that there was no possibility of falsification. As long as there's other evidence showing or establishing that a reasonable jury could find that the document or the evidence is what it purports to be. The question I have is whether, as part of that showing, there isn't some kind of need to show that the likelihood that there is, it's more probable than not or less probable than not that this type of evidence could be falsified or this specific piece of evidence could be falsified. I mean, to what extent does that factor into the directed verdict type analysis that we've been talking about?
Well, I believe that when we talk about that, you know, why shouldn't this receive enhanced scrutiny because of the very nature of the media? It's very susceptible to fraud or forgery. The rules are adapted to deal with that. And if we start saying it's subject to enhanced scrutiny, we will, by function, change the rule and the burdens involved in the rule. And the Griffin court, the dissent in Griffin, addressed that and said, that may be true, but where you just have the general argument, which is this media is susceptible to forgery and fraud, therefore...
No, we understand, or I understand that.
And what the dissent said was, that may be true, but those are all ripe for cross-examination. There's nothing that prevents cross-examination on those subjects. So in the absence of evidence to the contrary, so in the absence of a genuine dispute about the authenticity, if we're just talking about the general susceptibility of it, then there's nothing that prevents the opponent of the evidence from cross-examining on that subject.
All right, well, let's take a specific hypothetical. You want to introduce into evidence a Facebook, as of a certain point in time, and the Facebook is on the account of the defendant, has his or her picture, and it has a statement that was posted with a date under the defendant's picture. We don't know who posted it, but whoever did it looks incriminatory. Is that enough to get to the jury?
It's enough to satisfy the burden, yes. The burden before the judge, and Judge Grimm takes us through, it's almost a dual burden. The burden of the proponent of the evidence, the burden of the proponent of the evidence has before the judge under 104A is a slight burden. When we take a look at 901 and 104, it's a slight burden, and Judge Grimm describes it as prima facie evidence, that it is what the proponent says it is. And the judge has to find, so that's the first hurdle, and then the second hurdle is the judge has to determine whether or not a reasonable jury could find by a preponderance of the evidence that it is what the proponent says it is. And I had trouble wrapping my head around that.
That's really what has to be shown to get it to the jury.
The judge need not be satisfied himself. However, the judge has to be satisfied that a jury could find by a preponderance of the evidence that is authentic.
Okay, and measured by that standard, if we assume the hypothetical that you and I just discussed, are you saying that that Facebook with that content and no, without more evidence would be enough to get to the jury?
Yes.
Can I ask, did the victim authenticate this evidence?
Yes.
And you would agree that that would be necessary, whoever is the source, so to speak, of where this media evidence came from, has to be there and be shown the page and be under oath and say, you know, was this on your computer and did we take this from your computer, right?
Certainly.
So it would be much like a photograph that you present it to the person and say, is this an accurate depiction of, you know, the crime scene at the time of the crime? And they say yes or no. If they say yes, then it's admissible.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. And in the cases that are cited in the papers, oftentimes it is either the recipient of a message on Facebook, or it is, in the case of Tienda, the detective who saw these, who saw the posts. And in the other cases, I believe there are also police officers, but the state certainly suggests that, yes, you do need a live witness to talk about at least where the post came from in order to start off the authentication process.
Now, in terms of pretrial disclosure, all of this Facebook page was produced in discovery and information relating to it, so that if someone wants to have a forensic expert involved, that there's enough information to do that?
In this case, I do not believe that was the case. I believe this came up literally on the eve of trial, if not the day of jury selection. In other cases where we have such evidence, that would, of course, be the preferred procedure. If we have Facebook evidence that we want to introduce, disclosure to the defense ahead of time would certainly be something that we'd want to do, or the proponent of any of that kind of evidence would want to do. But in this case, the way I read the record is that this was not well in advance of trial. This was literally eve of trial or day of trial that this happened.
Mr. Vella, I asked this question of Mr. Tricotti, that is, if there was error here, was it harmless? And he said absolutely not. It would have tipped the scales unfairly. What is your position?
Well, the state disagrees with that, and the state argued in the brief that it is, in fact, harmless error. It was harmless error, if it was error at all, to admit this. The case was a close case in the sense that it was a self-defense case. Nonetheless, Tiffany Parker acknowledged having fought with the victim. There was a witness who watched Tiffany Parker beat up the victim. Her name is Felicia Johnson. And the post itself did not tip the scales. The post itself was a dual-edged sword for the state because it was exculpatory.
What was incriminatory or incriminating?
The incriminating part of the post simply is that it identifies her as being in a fight with the victim, and it's used at least in part to identify her as part of the state's burden, which is why the state introduced it in its case in chief, to identify her as the victim's assailant. But it is otherwise exculpatory, and the state would suggest that this was not the linchpin of the state's case. This was simply evidence that Tiffany Parker was involved in a fight with the victim.
So if that Facebook page had not been introduced, you're saying you would still have enough to get to the jury based on the eyewitness's testimony?
Yes. If the court has no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
If I could, I'd like to begin with the methodology that Justice Berger alluded to, and as far as what, you know, where do we go from here, or what are courts to do? And I think we wouldn't be here if Tiffany Parker was asked, is this your Facebook site, or is this your posting? In many of the cases, that's 901B1, a person with knowledge. The problem here is that we had a person without knowledge talk about the person who wrote it. So that's the flaw in 901B1. And that's why the court had to go to 901B4 to use the circumstantial evidence to see if it met the minimal standard. But easily, in cases like this, they can go right to the heart of the source and say, is this your account? Are you the person who wrote this? And that's what's lacking in this case.
Well, your client did take the stand, didn't she?
Yes.
And the state never asked?
That's correct. So that's why we get to the circumstantial evidence here in this case. And again, I think the state and the defense position is maybe a little bit more closer than it purports it to be, because we're not asking for a different set of rules. 901 is sufficient, we understand that. But just like when we have cell phone records, when the state wants to admit cell phone records or text messages, they cannot just authenticate a message or that a cell phone number was called. They have to have authenticity from either the cell phone provider, somebody who comes in who says, I looked at the records, I examined the cell phone, this call came in at X amount of time, the call was 30 seconds long. You need that minimal level of authenticity to get it in. That's what's lacking in this case.
All right. assuming there was error, getting back to the harmless error question, you said this was a she said case, and therefore it was very close. But the Facebook information, that evidence didn't, it was exculpatory in terms of the substance of the comment that was shown to the jury, right?
Well, that's not the entire picture, unfortunately, Justice Berger. When you take the post as a whole, there's discussions about implicating Ms. Parker. As the state points out, it's a double-edged sword. There is evidence implicating her in the altercation, and that's the problem. And the witness, both the complainant and the victim, went to the hospital in this case. That was before the jury, too. They both went to the hospital regarding after...
Let me interrupt you for a second. Your client took the stand and denied ever having any kind of altercation with the victim?
No, she claimed self-defense in this case.
Okay, so if she acknowledges that there was a fistfight or an altercation, and that is also something you would get from the Facebook evidence, why does that additional evidence become that important that it would change the result?
Because if it were up to defense counsel at trial, when he initially made the objection, he didn't want any of the Facebook evidence to come in. Because what comes in is all of the language regarding her animosity towards her, you know, the history between them. So this was really the only reason that this was used in defense was because it was Plan B. Plan A was to exclude all of this evidence. But the defense counsel hands were tied once the judge said, this is coming in, so he had to use what he had. And that's why he used it. Unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and recess.